Everybody, welcome to another edition of the Health Tech Pigeon podcast, where the Somex team read all the health tech news 2 minutes before this call and wing it to make it sound like we know what we're talking about. This week, I've got Belle, Daisy and producer Adam are with me, all from the Somex team, and we are going to be talking about AI and empathy, and can AI feel empathy? We're going to be talking about women's health, of course, and we're going to be talking about wearable AI and the future of operating systems potentially being screenless. So without further ado, I'm going to jump into our first story. That is from The Conversation, which you can find at theconversation.com. And they are, well, the headline is, increasingly sophisticated AI systems can perform empathy, but their use in mental health care raises ethical questions. Now, I, in good timing, have been actually writing a talk about this because, for those of you that follow my content, you'll know that I've spoken to Dom Pimenta from Tortoise, who is NHS doctor and AI entrepreneur, and thinks deeply about the philosophy of AI. I've done a couple of podcasts with him on the philosophy of AI. And one of the things that I'm doing in a couple of weeks' time is giving this talk at the Digital Healthcare Show. And it's about the AI revolution in healthcare. And it's about this kind of utopia versus dystopia. Can AI actually feel empathy? And should we be using AI, particularly with large language models now blasting onto the scene, should we actually be moving to a place where we put AI systems, large language model systems, clinical facing between the clinician and the patient so that the interaction for diagnosis and talking therapies is with technology? Anyone with a regulatory background will cringe at that statement. And it's interesting because what this article talks about, it goes on the premise, it's by a researcher who has multiple publications to their name, and they talk about the fact that AI can feel empathy, but is it enough? They talk about this concept of emotion AI, and the emotion AI market, by the way, projected to be worth $14 billion by 2032, and that growth is because of the application of it expanding across all sectors: healthcare, education, transportation, advancements in ML, advancements in natural language processing, allowing for this really sophisticated analysis of people's emotional cues and then reflecting that back. Now, I've done a lot of research on this and a lot of reading. I've been down many a rabbit hole on Google Scholar and read quite a few papers. And I guess here's my understanding of this and how it relates to healthcare. So in order to define perfect healthcare, it requires, I think, two things. It would be a flawless diagnostic and treatment component, i.e. whatever you have, you interface with the healthcare system and you get the perfect diagnosis and therefore the perfect treatment, restricted only by current research and modern advances. But it's also the perfect patient experience. So I think you need both of those in order to define perfect healthcare. Now, the perfect patient experience, it's really interesting because when I was researching on this, there are certain components that contribute to a perfect patient experience, but one of, if not the biggest, is empathy. So now, in order to deliver, inverted commas, perfect consultation, you would need to demonstrate perfect empathy. Now, with the advancements in large language models, the interesting thing is you see these sort of, you know, headlines, for example, in this article, sophisticated AI can perform empathy. Now, that's a really interesting statement because in my academic research here, I'm going to call it academic research, my small but mighty literature review that I did across this. There are three types of empathy. There's cognitive empathy. Well, I'll put it into two groups. There's cognitive empathy and there's emotional empathy. Cognitive empathy is the capability to understand point of view, reasoning, things like that. Emotional empathy is the capability to understand emotion. Now, AI is incredibly good now with large language models at a sort of synthetic cognitive empathy. It can pretend to understand your point of view, your reasoning. It can't truly understand because it isn't human. It doesn't have a motivation. But it can pretend to understand your point of view and reflect that back to you. And it's interesting because the components of cognitive empathy are essentially to take perspectives and find common ground. AI is really good at this, and that can have a positive effect. The difficulty with this is that it's not true empathy because it lacks emotional empathy. And when we go back to thinking, what is the perfect consultation? There was a really interesting study that was done, Finset et al. For those of you that want to look this up.
I love how much you're enjoying that you've got references.
I'm loving this. I am absolutely loving this. It takes me back to like my dissertation stuff. But patients disclose their history selectively to physicians according to how emotionally attuned and empathic in real time they perceive their physician to be. So what this basically means is that it's on a sliding scale. The more empathic you are, the more patients will disclose their histories to you, and that empathy can be built over time. And so an AI interaction that is only doing either a half or a third, however you want to divide it, but only some of what true empathy is, and it's synthetic, it isn't true empathy, you are not going to get a good enough history. Well, arguably you might get a good enough history. You're not going to get the perfect history. We're talking in sort of a utopia perspective here. You cannot get the perfect history without true empathy. Therefore, you can only get the perfect history with a human. And so essentially, what this leads to are some very bold statements. Montemayor et al., for those of you that don't believe that this is based on research. Empathic AI is either impossible or unethical. We are building in too much luck and risk if we depend on AI at the clinical interface because it lacks true empathy. And so my case, therefore, is that you should never put AI at the clinical coalface where you are expecting it to perform any task that involves empathy because you erode the fabric of what true healthcare really is, which is a patient feeling cared for. And therefore, as I say, you should never put it at that coalface. There is a caveat, a contradiction in my own mind even, that I've said on this and my other podcast, like I used something called Wobot, which I used. It displayed plenty of cognitive empathy towards me and my situations and did help me. But I'm someone that hasn't had any diagnoses of clinical depression or anxiety, posing any sort of risk of getting into any sort of clinical territory. And in that kind of gray area of propping up my mental health to keep it within, let's call it, normal range, it was very good at that because it posed no risk, in my opinion. I wasn't expecting it to have true empathy for me. I was using it for what it is. I think, though, that where we're seeing AI and the uses of it expanding into potentially diagnostic areas with a history, or indeed treatment areas with talking therapies, I kind of agree that it is either it's impossible to call it empathic, and it's unethical to put it there, because we cannot claim we understand the motivation of an AI, and for true empathy it needs agency and motivation. So there's my case. Keen to hear your guys' thoughts.
I think one of the interesting things in terms of motivation is that an AI's motivation is to appear human. So it is to appear empathic. That is really the only motivation of, we've seen that with ChatGPT and things, like, it is successful if you think it is a human or you feel like what you're reading could be written by a human. So its success metric is way off where a doctor's or clinician's would and should be when they're dealing with a patient and patient-facing appointments and things like that. I think this question of empathy is interesting because a lot of it is so obvious in your bones. I think everyone has experienced a situation where you've gone into a doctor's office and you've either felt listened to or not listened to. And that has completely changed what you take away from that scenario. Now, if you don't feel listened to or you feel judged or anything like that, you're less willing to give away more information anyway. You might have underlying nervousness, embarrassment. There's a whole host of things that come into that room with you, as well as just, here are my symptoms that I'm here to talk to you about. And it might be that a doctor says the right words, but if a patient doesn't sense that they are with them and they trust them and they are non-judgmental and they really believe what they're hearing and saying, if a patient doesn't feel all of that, the outcome could be wildly different. And I know you mentioned there, James, as well, about this relationship that builds over time. And I think we've discussed this in a few previous episodes as well, which is that once you have that trustworthiness, you start to establish a relationship with a doctor. That's obviously why you have family GPs and things. So you don't get flip-flopped around between different doctors and things. Difficult when everyone's on 12-month rental contracts and things. But having that established relationship and trust also allows you to not only feel comfortable in that scenario, but it means the doctor is able to look at a cluster of symptoms over maybe a 6 month, 12 month, 18 month, 2 year, 10 year period of time and actually build up a picture of this person's overall health. And especially when it's a complicated thing, which it often is, one appointment is never normally enough. And I know there's sort of the phrase that people say, it's the things that people say in the last 30 seconds of an appointment, which is often the real reason they're here. And they come in and they've got their doctor's appointment and they think, oh, I'll just bash off a few things that have been bothering me while I'm here. And actually the real reason is that thing that you're worried about in your bones and maybe don't feel that you can just say off the bat. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's fundamental that you build up this empathic, emotionally resilient relationship with your practitioner and vice versa. And whilst AI can do a really, really good job of looking and feeling like it's doing that, it can't bring with it the body language, the attuned emotional engagement, the active listening that people are looking for when they're in that appointment.
Just on that, yeah, it is. Also, it's not that I'm right, it's that Montemayor et al, etc. are right. But yeah, it's interesting that you say to appear. And you said it might be that the doctor says the right words, but they're not doing that active listening. Actually, one of the studies that I did see was that they got a humanoid robot to say the right words and or nod in agreement in order to build empathy. So some of these studies now are actually trying to break that down as to, like, what are the components of the things that drive cognitive empathy, or what are the things that allow the perception of empathy? So they are actually trying to break that stuff down, I guess, in the more kind of behavioral science worlds. And actually saying the right words was more impactful than nodding was one of the things that they looked at, albeit quite a weird study, sitting in front of a robot and have it try and be empathic towards you. But it's interesting that that weirdness is what ultimately comes out, because empathy is actually it's feeling that there is a two-way street between your situation and what's going on in their mind. And without that feeling, you can have all of the components of cognitive empathy. It can even, by the way, AI can demonstrate some of the reflection required to show emotional empathy. It can actually do some of those things too, not all of them. But ultimately what it comes down to is that trust that you talked about is only built on the understanding that the other side is human. It's actually not possible to do that. Current research pending, etc. But it's not actually possible to do that unless it's not true empathy, unless the other side has a perception of emotion in a very human way. It's fascinating stuff.
It's like the literal ability to understand and to like vicariously imagine yourself been in a similar situation, which obviously by nature of AI can't actually do, whilst it can pretend to do that. And just to pick up something as well that you were saying, Belle, is that whilst AI, you know, these kind of applications are getting more and more nuanced and learning more and more about the human condition and how to be more human, but realistically, can an AI ever be more human than a human? And really, I mean, it's impossible, right? Or it seems to be. And do we need AI in this application? Do we need to? Whilst AI is a fantastic tool and there is lots of applications for it and will do a wealth of good as well as a wealth of bad if in the wrong hands. But do we need it in this sphere of tech? And I'm not 100% sure if we do. I think there is, you know, I think there is a space for kind of having a kind of chatbot counselor type situation, but I don't think it ever should really replace going and seeing a therapist or having a conversation with your therapist, because whilst those nuances and learning how humans communicate, there will always be things that even humans miss, even though we are human, and AI might be able to fill those gaps, but it goes both ways. I think, you know, the subtle variances in voice or micro expressions, which AI has proven it can pick up on, but how is it going to effectively know how to help those patients in the right time correctly? And not everyone's perfect. Not every counsellor or therapist can do that, but at least, you know, we don't lose that human connection.
I think ultimately empathy is a superpower. It is the thing that fundamentally makes us human. And so to bring it right back to James's initial point, let's use AI to do the things that are not fundamentally human and take that extra admin or stuff off it. And let's empower humans to do what humans do best, which is to understand and communicate with each other.
100%. And it's a great point, Daisy, because do we need it to be at that intersection of patients and AI to diagnose and treat when it comes to that stuff? I don't think so. I think you guys are absolutely right. Like, I feel like it's wasted energy. I feel like it's wasted energy trying, because it's funny, the talk I'm going to give at the Digital Healthcare Show, I've got a slide that just says, well, if not this, then what should AI do? And the answer is literally everything else. Like, literally everything else. It can do everything else, just not this. Free us up to do this. You speak to any clinician, what do they want? They want to actually go in and practice at the top of their license. They want to do the care. They want to do the thinking behind it. And there's one thing you said, Daisy, there about filling in the gaps. I don't mind it if the AI is listening the entire time, a controversial statement. I don't mind it listening the entire time. And just before I'm letting that patient go out the room, the AI flags and is like, you didn't ask about PR bleeding. Just ask that. That's a red flag you can't miss. Just make sure you ask that. Fine. It's filled in a gap there. It's filled in a real significant gap there. It's been used. It's analyzed the conversation. Large language model has analyzed the conversation and decided I've not picked up this red flag. And then it might say, you know, here's three or four things that may or may not have made the thing better, but it's going to nudge me on those. Like, again, I don't mind that. It's teaching me to be a better technical clinician based on sort of latest research and knowledge, rather than like telling me how to be a human being and conduct my consultation, which I believe I've done around the houses in a non-specific way because I know the patient in a human way and all the rest of it. I also think that I don't think this research is actually a waste of time. I'm using that inflammatory language like intentionally, but like I think for other industries, this is probably quite useful. It's probably quite useful to know and understand things to this level, to develop a level of cognitive empathy in order to be used across industries. I don't know, like if you're shouting down the phone and making a complaint or whatever, but...
So- Do you think it could be, well, yeah, I've heard, I think that would be a great application, but do you reckon you could spin it? So almost to use it as a tool to teach therapists and psychiatrists and counsellors, like they could be the therapist and the counsellor, and you can have something that's very human and has, you know, appears to have lots of human traits and can understand empathy and all those innate nuances to then help train.
Yes, I do.
Professionals.
Yes.
Like, I think that would be a really great way to use that.
But acknowledging that it's only going to be cognitive empathy that it's able to display and reflect. If you acknowledge that, and you acknowledge that, and again, like in that scenario, the trainee, there's less ethical consideration there because the trainee knows that it's an AI and knows its limitations, and then doesn't feel robbed when they have an emotional response to this technology, expecting it to be human in some way. And so I think you've basically just, that transaction is fully informed and everybody's understanding there. And actually, I'm sure there are medical students around the world even that are currently using it, going like, you are a blah, 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 blah with this condition, like, da-da-da, I'm going to ask you questions and da-da-da. And then they bring their mate into the room who hasn't seen the vignette, and then they've got a diagnosis. If I was a med student, that's exactly what I'd be doing, preparing for finals, 100%. But yeah, then you're perhaps conversing with a patient with schizophrenia and you don't know you are, like, but it's an AI and therefore you're learning and all the rest of it. And then it can give you probably a nice summary of how you did and what it would do differently. But again, on the understanding that it's cognitive empathy, if you are indeed asking about how you were in empathy. But yeah, it's fascinating stuff, this, because you're right, Val, like intuitively we know this isn't quite, that's not the right thing. It's not even quite like, this isn't the right thing to do. We know intuitively as human beings, like that's not the part of care that this should be fired at. God, especially if you've done anything clinical, like, and you've put a hand on a patient and spoke, like, you know intuitively this isn't the right thing. Like, I guess learning what I have learned, and I'm at the beginning of this learning journey, but like learning what I have learned already about the various types of empathy and synthetic cognitive empathy, and that's what AI is good at, versus emotional empathy, which is not, and actually true empathy being literally only reserved for humans. Like, this language has allowed me to now put like an actual framework around this in order to actually demonstrate my points slightly clearer, perhaps, but still I imagine clear as mud to others. But
we'll just call this episode Pigeon et al.
Yeah, people will be quoting it, Pigeon et al. Podcast, 5th of April 2024. Anyway, that was our first story, guys. Yeah, quite a big one. And yeah, if you wanna come listen to me babble on about that stuff, head to the Digital Healthcare Show at the XL in a couple of weeks' time, and I'll put a bit of content out to say when and where that is, etc. So our second story today, Sylvia Kang has founded Mira to fill the gap in the women's health market. Daisy, what is going on here?
Sylvia, Mira's founder, born in China, former pianist, bioengineer and business manager, a bit of everything really by the sounds of it. So she's created a lab device, a mobile platform infused with AI for fertility and women's health support. And, you know, we all love a bit of femtech. That's something that I am myself are very, very interested in, obviously. So looking through what Sylvia has been through. She's had, you know, her drive to creating this product has come from her own personal experience, which I think a lot of, that's where a lot of femtech kind of comes out of, is feeling like, oh, I've gone through this thing and I don't have anything here to help me yet, so why don't I be the person to create this piece of like software or hardware. So she's currently looking at FDA and CE approval for the device.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this is that this is hardware. So this is...
Yeah.
And I don't want to say Theranos vibes, but it is an at-home medical device that, and let me pull the exact phrase here, an at-home lab panel that gives you an expanded view into five important biomarkers. It translates your key fertility hormone results into numbers while you brush your teeth in the morning. So from now on, you can make fertility plans feeling confident. That is what I think is fascinating here, that you've got the laboratory device in your home. Of course, then it connects to your phone. There's a nice image here of it literally connecting into an iPhone. And yeah, the app displays your fertility score. The AI behind it learns about the body, trained on over 10 million hormone data points, and they've won a few awards. Yeah. Best ovulation test, according to the Best of Bump Awards 2023. And a couple of others. It's FDA listed, FSA and HSA eligible. So ticking all the right boxes, written about in Forbes and Vogue. So, I mean, this is, yeah, really interesting.
I really love that as well. This has come from, she's going to buy her own 3D printer and just like create prototypes, like that kind of just, you know what? Like, I'm just going to do this off my own back and see where I go with it. I think that's just a nice origin story when you hear about how these like techs come into play.
It is, yeah. And it's sort of like the, I guess people in the States would call it the American dream, wouldn't they? She bought her own 3D printer, just decided, hey, I'm going to solve this problem myself, showed investors, got some funding, taught herself loads of stuff, and yeah, went from there. They've got, I mean, they're hugely fast growing as well. So this is worth noting that they've got, I mean, they're in America's fastest growing femtech. They are America's literal fastest growing femtech company by Inc. 5000. But yeah, 100 employees, sold 130,000 devices. But the thing that I guess this comes up for me is like, there's something here about, yeah, you're right, Daisy. She had to get up and sort this problem herself. There's something for me that's the personal responsibility of healthcare here. It still seems like it's falling to women to sort a lot of these problems out themselves. And perhaps it's just something about the times that we're in, maybe, that people are just taking more responsibility. But I don't know, like selling it B2C, like, or B2B2C, making it an employer problem. Like, I don't know. There's just something for me of like, whilst this is awesome and empowers people and the rest of it, it still feels like, I feel like men can get a lot of their problems solved by the healthcare system in the UK for free by just going into the NHS. It doesn't seem that way for women, if you know what I mean. A lot of the women, like, whether it's really long endometriosis diagnoses that take forever, whether it's anything to do with fertility, which by the way is a two-person problem disguised as a one-person problem. I don't know. There just seems to be this inherent sort of bad taste that's left with this of like, yeah, this is great, but just, I don't know if that makes any sense to you guys.
Yeah. Whilst I think women are greatly placed to you know, be the pioneers for women's tech, I think that's wonderful and it gives women lots of opportunity to excel in this field. What you constantly hear, though, is like they struggle. So they have this wonderful product and they have this great idea, which has been born out of necessity, except when they try to get people on board, that's the struggle. And I think that's where it comes to getting men on board. And like you said, this is a fertility issue. It's a two-person problem disguised as a one-person problem. And then it's, you know, it's trying to like this is serious, and this also affects people who aren't women. So actually, you know, why is it such a struggle, really?
Okay, I'm going to just jump in at this point just to explain what it is, because I don't think we've actually talked about what the device is and how it works. So James obviously mentioned it's an at-home device. It's basically a bit like a pregnancy test. You don't wee on the stick, but you wee into a cup and dip it into the stick. So it is using your urine as the vessel for which to track your hormones. And it's doing that through what it calls immunofluorescent technology. If we've got any chemists listening, fluorescence is my favourite thing. And take me to the pub, buy me a gin and tonic and some salt, and I'll show you it in action. But the thing that makes it non-theranos-y is that there's no like finger pricks, there's no blood tests or anything here. It's kind of the intermediate ground between people who are tracking their periods online using apps that often use basal temperature, so thermometer, and they track your temperature every day and use that to basically predict when you're ovulating. It feels like an intermediate ground between that and something a bit more invasive. So it's something you can do at home. It doesn't feel invasive, but you've got that daily log, so you see your body changes over time. And that's the really nice bit where it logs up in your phone and you can see that tracking over time. You can see, you know, they've got a lovely graph on their thing where it shows ovulation, but it also shows your kind of luteal phase as like different hormones such as luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, how they are changing over time. And it might be a bit of a throwback to A-level biology where you see these hormones dip and peak at different times and then you've got ovulation. So it's an interesting thing and is empowering. James, I think you're totally right in that this is often a problem which is falls to women. I think a lot of that is systemic and sad and angering. I think there's a background as well here of the fact that in this day and age, people, and I use the word responsibility, but I'm going to use it in a slightly different term here, but people are taking more responsibility for their fertility, because we live in a world where you can kind of choose when you want to become pregnant. You can sort of optimize for that. And in hard economic circumstances and things like that as well, that's more important than ever. So actually being able to track fertility and make it work for you is more important than ever, really, because the ramifications of potentially falling pregnant at the wrong time can be severe for people, as access to contraception and abortion wanes, as, you know, sexual health clinics are underfunded, as we know there are huge waiting lists for things. You can't get IVF without having tried unsuccessfully, like physically having had multiple miscarriages. Like it's a horribly sad state of affairs. And one of the things they mention here as well is obviously this can be used by anyone interested in their fertility. But specifically, one of the kind of groups of people that they're supporting is people with PCOS who inherently struggle to have healthy pregnancies. And so they've kind of got some studies, they've carried out some studies and got some data to show that they've supported people with PCOS to carry through to a healthy pregnancy, which is pretty fascinating. And then one extra thing before I hand back to you, because I can tell you want to say stuff, and this ties into what Daisy was just mentioning here. It's a women's problem. And when we link this back to the business point of view, separate to a particular women's health product, even if that were not the case, we know that women don't get the investment and funding that they need as often as men do, that they struggle to raise investment. And we know particularly that when it's a women's health product, that barrier is so much harder because of embarrassment about talking about things in the room, about men feeling like it's not their problem or it's not a big problem. So there's a big education piece to go here, right at the level of where the money is. And, you know, this is a great example of, yeah, the American dream. She's made the device. She's got the data. She's pitched the people. She's got the money. She's in Forbes. She's won the awards. It's brilliant, but it's not always the case. And there is so much more that needs to be done here in educating people that not only is this everyone's problem, but we need to be funding this. We need to be funding research that fuels this. And ultimately, we need women and their fertility to be taken more seriously in the healthcare system. Because what the hell is going on, honestly? That, I mean, I read something literally yesterday. I can't remember who it is. I will find it and we'll link it in the notes. There's an ad campaign at the moment about maternity statistics in the UK, in that they are, I think maternal deaths are at the highest in like 100 years or something. And don't quote that exactly, I will find it and we'll link it below, but it's terrifying. And for Black mothers, that's so much worse. That's a historic problem. We know that, but again, it's rising. Here's a problem that is so important and vital that we talk about now. And so how can we ensure that we don't just allow it to fall to individuals to solve these problems in a unique way?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's put way better than I was going to, but it's the exception, not the rule, isn't it? As you say, in this story. And that's the bit that just doesn't sit quite right with me. I need to probably just figure that out myself and figure out why a bit more, but it just doesn't sit quite right with me. The other thing is, when I started my neonates placement, I remember the consultant there on that day when we all started, that gave us the talk, said that, just remember that all those women over there are not unwell. They haven't got any disease processes going on. They are normal. They are healthy. And you should treat them as such. This is the only place in the hospital where a normal human process is going on that we are supervising. We are making sure that everything goes as it should be. This is a normal process. And I mean, besides that, that was just a really illuminating comment at the time.
I love that.
You can end up thinking very differently. It framed it. It was perfect to say on the first day, because it just framed everything completely differently for me. I think, though, where that then hits what we're talking about here, one of the things is, when we put our hands in our pockets to optimize our own health, there's a question about how much should we be doing that? How much should the NHS be doing? How much of this should be more accessible to more people?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is optimizing health. Fertility at the moment is considered, or these types of activities are not considered the norm. You know, Health Tech Podcast Live with Helen, you know, talks about this incredibly eloquently. Like, it's not the norm that we're monitoring fertility, even though if you speak to Hertility, they monthly, I believe, they are testing their fertility hormones to ensure they have a baseline, so that if anything changes or they need to make earlier decisions about when they're getting pregnant or anything, like all of these things, like the empowerment that comes with more information actually changes the way that they live their lives. It changes the way that when they eventually have children, or how they eventually have children, or what additional help they might need. And it seems that what we do, and I've heard Helen talk about this on a different podcast, but like I've heard, like what we're essentially doing is telling women, you should not get pregnant. Do everything you possibly can to not get pregnant. There's all these different contraceptions, like do not get pregnant. Like that's sort of what you're told, until a point where all of a sudden it's like, now do a complete 180, and it's all about do everything you possibly can to optimize fertility, because now you're 30 and like da 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 da. And it's like, it's such a complicated like message. Like it's exhausting. Like, and I'm not, it doesn't even affect me personally, but like I'm exhausted for my friend, my fiance, my friends, the people around me, my family. Like it's exhausting for me to be a kind of supporter and advocate of it, like even let alone what it does to other people. And I worry about the messaging of like, at that point where it flips 180, by the way, this is now your problem. By the way, you got to put your hand in your own pocket now. And now you've got to optimize that fertility that you've blasted with. By the way, see how many men will take a pill that inhibits their sperm generation. How many men would take that pill? How many men get vasectomies? Because it's just, it's a surgery and I don't want it. Like, try a coil, mate. Like, I don't know. There's so much of this that the messaging around it is like, right now, fertility is your problem, and you've got to put your own hand in your own pocket, because that is optimizing your health. I don't know, there's something there for me. It doesn't strike me as okay.
No, I agree. And actually, you've maybe just literally think back to being 13 and having like sex ed classes for the first time. And like you say, you're taught all about this is how you get pregnant. These are the different methods of contraception. And this is how you stop getting pregnant. At no point are you taught about how one would go about optimizing for pregnancy.
Right.
It's just not a thing. And again, to talk to Helen being very eloquent and dropping all the facts, you know, there's a hard cutoff in fertility about 30. And I think she said most people think it's 35, not 30. You're not told that. And you're still in education till your early 20s. Mm. There's not a long gap for you to do that finding on your own. Nor should you have to. It is basic health that affects half the people in any classroom across the world. And yet, and like, well, actually, like you say, it actually affects everyone. But if you were to talk specifically about women's fertility, it's mad that we don't know anything about it and we don't know how to optimize and we don't know that. And as such, they're missing such a great opportunity to empower and make people feel excited and engaged with their own health and their own fertility. Mm-hmm. Because like you say, all of a sudden it's, you're over 30 now, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Or like,
by the way, that thing you've been suppressing massively, you now need to completely flip reverse that entire thing and go ham the other way and optimize everything. Like, yeah, it's
exactly. Drink these shots, drink these juice, drink these juices, do this, do a 180 in your like lifestyle.
Take these supplements, do this, da da da.
Yeah. And one, it costs money. But two, it instills fear and sadness and rage of something that should be empowering and exciting for women that want to do that. That's what's, it's just missing an opportunity. Capture people when they're teenagers and get them excited about things. Everyone's interests stem from a young age. This doesn't have to be a hobby. You don't have to be like, I'm going to fund the next thing in the future that's going to change the world. But it should be, you know, every woman you talk to will care deeply about their reproductive system in some way. It doesn't matter where you fall on it. Do want kids, don't want kids, have lots of problems, don't have problems. Everyone will have a deep, deep feeling about it. Seize that while people are in a formative phase. Educate boys and girls as to what we can do for this to prepare and just make it seem normal.
Yeah.
Because it is.
I agree. The obvious one that comes to mind as well is egg reserve. Like learning about your egg reserve at the final hour seems bizarre. Like what's the average age of people checking their egg reserve?
I saw a thing the other day saying that most people, I think the average age to freeze eggs is something like 39, which is 9 years later than when your eggs start to decline.
Right.
It's something like that.
So well, eggs decline from birth, don't they? You're like, born with the most eggs that you have and actually...
But when you get, that drop in fertility.
The quicker decline, yeah.
So most people are freezing at the point of which that's already passed. But obviously, egg freezing costs a ton of money. Very few people pre-30 are in a position financially or otherwise to be able to afford that.
Yeah.
It's mad. It's crazy to me that if 30 is such this finite line in the sand that affects nations, affects productivity, affects
population collapse,
how many pensions we're going to pay in the future. It affects so much. One, why the hell don't we know about it? Two, why aren't we equipped, informed, supported to do more with it? And then three, the underlying horrible thing is why a society got to a point where I can't imagine many people that would be in a position to be able to buy a bigger, like rent or buy a flat big enough for a family at that age.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like most people are in shared accommodation until their early 30s. Do you want a baby in that environment? Maybe, if it's great, like, but maybe unlikely not. The society we have is not supporting what society is purporting to need in terms of reproduction.
Completely agree. And I think what we're essentially advocating...
I could rant about this for ages.
Well, no, let's... we do have to go. But I think what we're saying is more education... in a positive way about the factors of fertility, rather than here's how to not get pregnant and here's all the 100 ways you cannot and therefore that you should not. And I think the world's moved on slightly. I think more education about those things. I think normalizing it as part of understanding one's health, both from a male fertility and a female fertility point of view, knowing and understanding that the human desire to reproduce kicks in at some point, and educating people on that, and therefore giving people the why behind that knowledge and understanding of one's own fertility. But then crucially, I think, not making it the individual's financial problem. In the UK, we're blessed with an NHS. And I think if to your point, Belle, about the effect on population, the effect on country, the effect on economy, and making it then the individual's financial problem doesn't necessarily make sense when you're faced with the potential of a declining economically active age group and population collapse. So perhaps can we not make the argument for
which we're seeing happen.
Economic argument for, you know, we set up arguments for screening, like we set up screening programs with financial arguments. I mean, it's part of the definition of how you set up screening programs. There has to be a financial component to it. The challenge is, does it deliver back on a five-year political cycle? Which government's going to enact it when the next government stands to benefit? That's the challenge there. So no one's going to advocate educating 10-year-olds when it's going to be 20, 30, 40, 50 years later that potentially benefits. Or would they? Could you set up a cross-parliamentary group to actually figure that out and shake hands across lines, etc., to get something done that benefits us all as a country? Who knows? That suggests a level of maturity they might not have.
It shouldn't be political.
You're right. No, I mean, let's not get into that or else we'll be here for another few hours. But, you know, you're right. Healthcare as a political football is ludicrous, is absolutely ludicrous because of these five-year timelines at best that it puts on big projects. Really difficult, really difficult. Any final thoughts, Belle, before we let everyone go?
It's just something which just popped into my mind. And I won't go massively into this because this is a whole other wormhole, but I don't know anything, just in your little summary there, I don't know anything about like male fertility, if there's a dip in that or a decline in that either. Like, I literally don't know. Everything I know about fertility is based on women because I am one and that's the research I've done.
And you're told that fertility is a women's problem.
Exactly. Like, I literally don't know anything about it. And actually, like, you know, you have this big graph and where's the male graph fall and where do you need to optimize for if that's something that you're trying to do? No final thoughts really. To bring it back to the story, this is a lovely thing. It's brilliant. As James has mentioned, and I think probably weaves through all of today's episode, information is power. More informed people can make better, healthier decisions for themselves and, you know, for healthcare systems at large. So this is an exciting thing. And maybe the first step into how we're going to start thinking about fertility moving forward as part of a greater picture. But congrats to the team. It looks exciting.
Beautiful. Thank you, Belle. Thank you, Daisy. Thank you, Adama, for joining me today on the Health Tech Pigeon podcast. If you want to grab the links to all those stories, you can head to healthtechpigeon.com, grab the newsletter, all that lovely stuff. And we will see you all next week.